The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Coming to your cordless now with fiber optic cable. Hi, how you doing? It's Tuesday night, May 7th, 2024. It's 11 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, 8 p.m. on the West Coast, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia, and here in Northeast Minneapolis, it's 10 p.m. Central Daylight Time. I am Jim Peters, and you are watching Jim Pete and listening to What Am I Talking About? You might be just listening to Jim Peters at Night, episode number 116, if you're keeping score on your bingo cards at home. Okay, yeah, so, we're on five video platforms, and we're also on Blog Talk Radio. So some of you might not see the picture. As a matter of fact, we get, at this point now, we get at least half of our calls from Blog Talk Radio. That's the reason we went on there. They have a fantastic live directory. You can see what's going on at any one particular time. All the shows are on when you tune in, when you go to their website and you click a button and then you're listening to us. It's simple. God knows we make this technology so freaking simple. Speaking of technology, all right, so tonight our guest is Robert Powell. He is a scientist. He's a member. Oh, geez, I better look. Hold on. I always get this confused. He's a member of he's on the board of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. That's a bunch of scientists who have gathered together to study UFOs. Formerly the director of research for MUFON, and he founded the MUFON Science Review Board. And he's also, and I got to ask him about this at the beginning, he's one of the developers of flash computer memory. That's kind of his claim to fame as a scientist. So we'll talk to him about that. He's written a book. The book is called UFOs. A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. It just came out last week. Yes, I read it. So I'm going to talk to him. We're going to talk to him about that. Now, his interview is live. So let me point this out here. You can see there's a banner on the bottom of the screen here. You want to call in with questions. You can call in with your camera, but I'm going to ask you not to tonight because I don't want to get a crowd of people on the screen. I'd suggest that you either call in via phone call in, which is this number right here. 563-999-3435. That's the Blog Talk Radio call-in number. If you go to our channel on Blog Talk Radio, you'll see the number there, too. And our channel at Blog Talk Radio is blogtalkradio.com/Jim at Night. Our channels everywhere are Jim at Night, and our website is at jimatnight.com. Also, you can text questions in this number right here, 408-458-5088. I will relay them. I got a monitor on the side here. Texts come up. And I will relay the questions as you text them in. Or if you want to call them, that's great. Like I said, I normally encourage you to call in with your webcam, but tonight I don't want to put people on the screen. Also, I would end up, as soon as you gave your question, I would end up dismissing you. So I don't know if it's worth the trouble. Anyway, Robert Powell's coming on in a few minutes. So what do we got going on? You know, we got it going on here. You know that. Okay, so tomorrow I'm taking the day off. Because I have a bunch of doctor's tests. You don't want to know. It's like, this becomes just a total pain in the ass. Don't become 68 years old. Don't, let alone my mother is going to be 100 years old in about 8 weeks, and she still lives on her own. Her mother lived to be 104, and still same thing. She was healthy till 2 weeks before she passed away. So who the hell knows what the hell is going to happen. But I'm big and fat now, so... You know, that's not exactly, I got an excuse. I had a hormone problem about 10 years ago that turned out to be misdiagnosed. I was mistreated and I gained a bunch of weight and now I can't get rid of it because I'm 68 years old. When I was 30, I could lose like 25 pounds in like a month, and I'm not actually exaggerating. I could. It's just I just stopped eating. It was simple, you know. Now I stop eating, nothing happens. Except I'm hungry. All right, so tomorrow I'm taking the day off. Thursday, this is really cool. We're doing a UFO panel. Now I gotta hand it to my friend Jazz Shaw at the UFO writer for Salem Media and HotAir.com for putting this together. So here's the panel. It's Jazz. Jim. John Greenwald from the Black Vault. And have you ever been to, you can go to the Black Vault at theblackvault.com. So now you've seen John's picture. He's been on like every goddamn UFO show on cable TV. He's been on Ancient Aliens, you know, Unsealed, Alien Fire. I mean, just it goes on. You've seen him everywhere. So we're happy to have him on here. It's very cool. The last count I got off of his website, he has 3.9 million government documents. These are verified government documents. They're not documents anybody made up or any of that sort of crap. He got them all from the Freedom of Information Act. So 3.9 million documents, you know, he's been a busy guy, and he has. This has basically become his full-time job. Matter of fact, I think he's been doing this for like 15 or 20 years now. So... And I've always said, you know, the reason, okay, Jim, how did you know the extraterrestrials were here? Well, it's because of government documents. That's how I knew. And then the question is, well, why didn't anyone else talk about it? And my answer is, I don't know. I mean, I have some speculation. I think there have been a whole bunch of people in the press that have been paid not to talk about it. That's what I think. But that's just speculation. I don't really know. All I know is that the documents were there. And even as early as the mid-1950s, the Air Force was sending internal memorandums back and forth saying, yeah, the UFOs are real, and yeah, we don't know who they are or where they come from. Yeah, fast forward 70 years to 2021, congressional report comes out, and the report states two things. The UFOs or UAPs, whatever you want to call them, are real flying machines. They're flying through the air. They're not imaginary and not fictitious. They actually exist. And number two, we don't know where they're from or who's flying them. Yeah, same conclusion, 70 years later. Now, we'll talk about with Robert. Robert deals in his book with part of this, about the fact that, I mean, the what's the word I'm looking for? Shit. Yeah. Yes, the mouth doesn't work, ladies and germs. Anyway, yeah, we'll talk to him about that. I'm not even going to try to say that word. But he wrote about that in his book kind of somewhat prominently. So, and also, okay, the fourth member of that panel is Mika Hanks. And Mika is the founder and editor of thedebrief.org, which is one of the most astute and respectable science and publications on the Internet. And if it's based, I mean, I hate to say this because they probably won't like it. Mika probably won't like it. It's kind of sort of, it's a website designed for defense contractors. It's basically kind of sort of for people who are in the military type realm. And they don't really deal with paranormal stuff. They deal with science, but they've come to the conclusion that the UAPs are not paranormal stuff anymore. So they write about it pretty extensively. So that's the panel, and Jazz, of course, and me, I will direct the questions. And also, if you have any questions for that, now, this is important, too. That panel discussion is going to be pre-recorded in the afternoon. So if you have any questions over the next couple of days, or you even want to email some in, you can email them to jim@jimatnight.com, and I'll pitch them to the panel. Or you can text them in, but the panel will not be live, so you can't call in while we're doing it. So, at any rate, so now we've gone through all the ways you can contact us, and we're talking to you. I want to show you this. This is our sponsor. This is Conk News. This is a live feed of the Conk News front page at this very moment. So Conk is a news aggregator. And you can't get a better news source on the web than this because it's actually 75 news sources plowed into one. So the way this works is that every 3 hours, the servers are calling news, go out to 75 predetermined websites that they They call themselves and gets any new stories they have, brings them back in, lays them out on the front page in chronological order, regardless of where they're from. In other words, you don't see like all the 10 stories from one place and 10 stories from another. They are in chronological order, regardless of the source. So it's basically an online newspaper, and it's the best online newspaper you ever find. So we're looking at the front page of Clog right now. By the way, that is my picture on the right-hand side, and they just added that a couple days ago. It's very nice of them because, yeah, because they sponsor the show. So we're very happy about that. At any rate, photos here are from the actual articles, and the headlines are from the articles. They're not rewritten. And if you click through, you go directly to that article on that news source. And I don't know if you can see this. There's little icons in the bottom right, left corner of every article, like the one on the left there. I keep moving my cursor around. You can't see my cursor. Who am I fooling? That's from hotair.com, if I'm right. What was I going to say? You go directly to the articles on that website. So you can spend 2 or 3 hours looking at this. I mean, this page is long. This is the top. And the latest stories are at the top, and it goes in reverse chronological order down at the bottom. You get older stories. And the thing is, since this updates every 3 hours, basically every 3 hours, 80% of the stories change. So you can come back in the afternoon and look at this. You can spend 2 or 3 hours reading this. And when I mean reading it, I'm not talking about reading this actual front page. I'm talking about clicking through the articles and reading them too. So it's the way the web is supposed to function. Links, that was the idea. Tim Berners-Lee, you know. I mean, he thought of this. You know, you get a link and you go someplace else, and this is exactly the way this is supposed to work. So if you're a news junkie, you can't find a better news source than this. I'm not kidding. I use this all the time. I used to work for this organization. It was fantastic. I'm very proud of it, and they're proud of it, and they should be. It's at conk.com. Well, one more thing, too, very, really, really important. Not only is this free, you don't have to register to see it. Now, you'll notice at the front, at the top, there's a menu at the top of the, you know, page like there is on most other websites. But this is essentially a one-page website. I mean, you probably won't, if you never click past the front page on Clog News, you're probably not going to miss a lot. So, it's at conk.com. Check that out. You want to do that. All right, so what happened today? I'll tell you what happened today. Stormy Daniels appeared at the Trump hush money trial, and it wasn't so much a disaster so much as that when she was done, the defense asked for a mistrial, saying that the testimony was completely irrelevant, and although the judge didn't grant them a mistrial, he basically agreed. He said, you know, she said some stuff has been said here that I wish we could take back. That's a direct paraphrase what the judge said. He actually didn't say that. I'm starting to get the impression. There's another thing that happened today, too, that kind of fell through the cracks of the news. The Trump Mar-a-Lago documents case has been indefinitely postponed. And like a lot of legal analysts said, when they say indefinitely, they mean it's not going to go to trial. It isn't. I get the impression that the Democrats have come to the conclusion that these trials are hurting them more than helping them. And they're starting to do it about face. Now, I mean, I've been saying this for 2 weeks. Trump is going to be, there's two things that are going to happen here in this quote unquote hush money case. He's either going to be found guilty or there's going to be a mistrial. If he is found innocent, I will just absolutely shocked, because these are called, in the legal parlance, nullified juries, a jury that you already know is biased toward a certain point of view. And in this case, it's the Democratic point of view, because Manhattan is the single most Democratic city. Well, if you're not going to include it, I think maybe you could even include in the entirety of New York City, all five boroughs, but Manhattan in particular is 92% Democratic. And these people, they hate Trump. I don't have to tell you. There's a whole bunch of people in America, they hate Trump. They don't know why. They can't tell you why. You know, he's a big evil orange man. You know, and MSNBC has spent years now cultivating this hatred. It's amazing. But the thing is, they didn't really have to cultivate it. Because, yes, I know a lot of people who hate Trump's guts. They can't tell you why, but they do. So, the documents case has been basically now voided. Now, and the amazing thing is the reality is that that was the only real case of the four of them where Trump actually probably broke the law. I mean, you know, I'm being speculative. I'm not an attorney and I'm not a jurist. But yeah, that was the one everyone was saying he had the highest chance of being found guilty of him, only because he probably was guilty. But that said, no one has ever been prosecuted under this law ever. And this may be the reason they decided to void this. Based on the report of Robert Hur, Biden broke this law more than Trump did. You know, I mean, this was the report where Hur said, well, we're not going to try. He probably is guilty, but we're not going to try President Biden because he's an elderly old man. This is where this all came from. And the thing with the Biden point of view is that Biden, some of these documents he had were not even from his vice presidency. Now, the rules about classified documents, there's exceptions made for presidents, and that's always what Trump has been claiming here. Whether that extends to vice presidents, that's kind of a gray area. They're part of the executive branch, but still, the statute doesn't actually say that. But they certainly don't extend to senators. Matter of fact, to see these documents as a senator, you have to go into what's called a SCIF, and that stands for Secure Compartmentalized Information Facility. Yeah, there, I said it. That's what it stands for. And a SCIF is basically a room in the Capitol that's completely hermetically sealed from radio transmission. You can't go in, you can't get a cell phone signal in there, none of that crap. And they won't let you take your cell phone in. And basically, they let senators who have certain clearances on certain committees, they get to come in and read and look at documents. You can't take them with you. You can't photograph them. There's people there monitoring you while you're sitting there, but you can come in and look at them. And somehow, Joe Biden, as senator, ended up with some of these documents. It's a clear violation of the law. I mean, you know, this is not the gray area for presidents or even maybe vice presidents. As a senator, you broke the law. And a lot of these documents, I don't know, I don't know how many, but at least some that Biden had on his possession in his stupid garage with his Corvette were from this era, and he had absolutely no business taking them. Matter of fact, this is the type of thing where in a SCIF, they won't even let in your staff. So if they were stolen, that means Biden stole them himself. There's no other way this happened. It's crazy. The guy, I mean, the guy ripped documents off, classified documents off of the government. So, I mean, this is way more blatant than what happened to Trump. Way more. I mean, Trump is claiming immunity, and that, you know, they were going to go to trial to figure out if that was true. But there's the thing with Senator Biden is completely clear cut. I mean, he stole documents. That's all there is to it. And they're not going to prosecute him. So the amazing thing is, this was of the four trials, this was the one that was the most legitimate, and now it's gone away. So, and of course, Stormy Daniels gets on today. And, you know, I don't want to talk about it. It's like, you know, I can blah, 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 blah. I know it's a talk show. I know I'm supposed to do that, you know, blah. It's just bullshit. It's complete, utter bullshit what's going on. And the Democrats have figured out this is backfiring on them. You know, and I don't, why do they think we're so stupid? Well, I'll tell you what. Here's another thing that's, you know, this actually occurred to me the other day. All these campus protests, and they're starting back up again. I don't know if they're going to match the fervor that they did a week or two ago. But, like, for example, a bunch of those kids who were kicked off the quad at Columbia University have now come back, or some of them have anyway. And Columbia canceled its commencement, you know, graduation ceremonies, and so have several other colleges. They don't want to deal with this. At the University of Michigan, their commencement was infiltrated by the Palestinian college squad. So, I mean, they already know this is going to happen. Everyone is predicting it's pretty much an open secret that at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August, there's going to be a huge demonstration. They're already talking about it. What occurred to me is, and I don't know, I haven't heard anybody else mention this, even though this is, when I stop and think about this, it's kind of master the obvious stuff. Are all these protests happening? Now, we know the protests are coordinated. We know that. They're nationally coordinated. And also, we have something they didn't have in 1968, and that is we have social media. So even if they aren't, even if there's not a quote-unquote mastermind involved here, it's still easy to coordinate stuff nationally among different groups of people because online there's no border, state borders, you know. So, but the thing that did occur to me is that, and also, like I said, we know that there's people, there's organizations that are attempting coordinate and are funding this stuff. But are they doing so to divert our attention from something else? And that would be, obviously, that would be Biden's really poor performance. That would be the obvious thing, you know. But then again, on the other hand, all right, you go back to summer of 2020. That was apparently, those protests partly were to point out supposedly inadequacies in Trump's presidency, that, you know, he couldn't control this. That was the idea. Now, Trump maintains, and which is rightly so, that's the thing, he was right about this, and that is it wasn't the executive branch's job to quell these protests because they were happening on a local and state level. So therefore, their state jurisdiction, you know. And so Trump was very hesitant to nationally do anything about it. But you can make the argument that they were doing that to, you know, try to highlight his quote unquote inadequacy. Now, are they doing this to take away from Biden's inadequacy? I don't quite understand. It's like, I mean, okay, so we went through this dance 4 years ago. Everyone's sick and tired of it. Everyone's now realizing it's a complete left-wing issue, totally. You know, I mean, I just find it, you know, you probably saw this on the news or online. Maxine Waters gets on MSNBC, I think it was, and she's saying, well, you know, Trump is going to try to take over the whole country. You know, it's like we're going to have militias, you know, the white supremacists, which of course, you know, I'm not the only person pointed out the white supremacists don't exist. Not statistically anyway. I mean, obviously, there's a few here and there. I think Bill O'Reilly had his staff at the No Spin News, tracked down. He wanted a question. The question was on a local, state, and national level, how many people have been convicted of white supremacy crimes in the last measurable period? I think the last measurable period was 2021, or maybe it was 2022. But the number he came up with, this is entirely across the entire United States, local, state, and national, the number of people arrested for white supremacy hate crimes was 106. Yeah, that's a huge freaking militia, isn't it? Yeah, you tell me about it. I mean, I'm not the only person who said this. Greg Gutfeld's going on and on about this all the time. He's absolutely right. There's no white supremacy. There isn't. I mean, yeah, like I said, I'm talking statistically. Of course, there's always somebody somewhere, you know, but there's 330 million people in the United States. You know, 106, do I need to do the math? It's probably 0.0000001%. And that reminds me, too, did you see the NASCAR race from last night? It was the closest finish in history. I can't remember the names of the guys now. He won by about 1 inch. And they overturned it on appeal. It was so close, so they were using they used the photo finish. Turns out the line on the track is crooked, but they have a laser system, which is definitive. And the lasers pointed out that, you know, who pointed out who won, basically. But it's never been, you know, and I think they said it was 0.0001 seconds. Okay, sure. And on top of that, the Timberwolves are just beating the Denver Nuggets ass. Last night, I didn't see the game, but I heard about the commentary afterwards. I mean, Barkley was just, there were people in awe they played so well. And the real amazing thing is, they didn't have their best defensive player who stayed behind in Minneapolis because his wife gave birth. So he missed the game, and they still played freaking awesome. Apparently the defense was unbelievable. If you're from Minnesota, it's like, we don't win this shit a lot. Vikings, can you say Vikings? Can you say Vikings? 1999 NFC title game. Yeah. Yeah, we don't win this stuff a lot. So anyway, so I'm getting off track here. But that's my point. My point is, if they're doing this to divert from something, it's kind of the opposite of what they did before. All right, so yeah, we saw this 4 years ago, Summer of Love, George Floyd dies. Now Liz Collin has made a really, really good case. She's a journalist here in town for the fact that Chauvin didn't kill George Floyd, that he died of natural causes on the spot. And of course, you know, it was the excuse they were looking for to start these protests. And everyone asked me, and Jeff Meyer just reminded me of this the other day, when I was doing radio shows for Conk News, and of course we started after, I was going to say we started after George Floyd died, but no, we actually did start beforehand. We started before then. But, you know, people asked me, you know, I said, you know, George Floyd died on a Monday afternoon. And everyone said, well, Jim, what's going to happen? I said, well, there's going to be a huge riot on Wednesday night. And they said, why Wednesday? Why not Tuesday? Because it's going to take Antifa 24 hours to get here. That's why. And it did. That's what happened. Oh, my God. Who would have thought that? I know. Us conservatives, we are such a threat to the Republic. It's unbelievable. Well, if I'm right, Robert Powell is here. And Mr. Powell, if you can hear me, I can't see you. So try coming back. Try exiting and coming back in. Okay? I don't know if you can hear me or not. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I can't see you. Try exiting and coming back in, okay? That
I'll
usually
do that.
Works. Thanks. So, yeah, we're going to talk to Robert Powell, author of the book UFOs, A Scientist Says What We Know and Don't Know, and we're going to find out what the scientist knows. That's what we do here. If you have a question, I'd like you to call it in, 563-999-3435. You can text your question in at 408-458-5088. I'm going to leave this banner on the bottom of the screen here for a good portion of the time so you can do that. We do live interviews. We give our guests the option of taping interviews in the afternoon. I do them, but we do them the afternoon that we play them, because I don't want any weird stuff happening in the news that we've only done. I've done one interview that was pre-taped the day before, and that was Michael Harrison for World Radio Day. And that was February 13th, I think it was. We taped that a day ahead of time because, it was either that or you couldn't do it, one or the other. So, and I got, I'm going to, one more thing I got here. I'm going to segue kind of into Robert's appearance here. And that is,
Robert Powell joined.
Robert?
Yes.
Still no picture.
Yes, I'm not sure what is happening here.
You want to try going out and coming back in one more time?
Yes, I'll try it one more time.
So I was going to say, Boeing was going to launch their Starliner spacecraft and send with its first manned mission to the International Space Station. And they scrubbed it. Now why am I laughing? Because this launch is 10 years overdue. They have not been able to get the spacecraft to work. They have sent it on, it has launched a few times unmanned, but this was the first manned mission, two astronauts and a whole bunch of payload. I mean, that's the reason they go up there. It's not so much, the trips aren't so much to bring up astronauts as they are to bring up supplies. Because you know something, there's no farms up there. They're not growing anything. I mean, they're probably growing stuff in the lab, but I don't think there's any cows. Did you ever see the show Ascension on the Sci-Fi Channel? It was about a spacecraft that was on its way to Alpha Centauri, 4 light years away. But it was a conventional, well, it actually wasn't conventional. It was a nuclear fission powered spacecraft that 600 people on board. It was about, the whole ship was bigger than the Empire State Building, but they actually had cows. They had livestock on board because, like, seriously, how are you going to have meat? You know, it was a 50-year mission, and there were people, they knew that there are people who, most people weren't going to last the entire way.
Jim, I'm not sure why you won't show video.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. Can you tell that you're not, that you don't have a picture?
Yes, I can tell that I don't have a picture.
I mean, I suppose we could do this without a picture, but needless to say, I prefer not. This is a TV show after all.
right, exactly. I've never had this type of problem before.
Occasionally we have this problem, but usually in the past, exiting and coming back in has always solved it. So.
Yeah, I'm I don't see any other camera options opened, you know, that might interfere.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I could reboot. Let's see.
I tell you what, why don't you try that? Try that, Robert. I got plenty to talk about here, so.
Okay.
Why don't you
reboot my computer then?
Yeah, try that. We'll see you soon. So I was talking about this Starliner Boeing spacecraft. Yeah. They've flown it a few times, but always unmanned. But this mission is literally 10 years overdue. They scrubbed it again. Apparently they had problems with some sort of just washers failing or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But yeah, it's not going up. And also, in other related news, completely unrelated, unless you're talking about near-death experiences, Bernie Sanders is running for re-election. He's 82 years old. This would be his fourth term in Congress, or is it his fifth? He's either been in Congress four terms, or this is his fourth term. I can't remember. But he's running for re-election, and which means that he would be 89 by the end of his next term. He's running this fall. Now, in his last election 6 years ago, he's had no trouble. He won by like 40 points. The people in Vermont love him, and he's almost certainly going to win again. But I just want to point out he is 82 years old. Now, we've talked about this before. Why? Everyone in Congress, all these people, they're freaking ancient. They're ancient. I mean, Chuck Grassley is 93 years old. Now, the amazing thing about Grassley is he's still with it. He hasn't lost a step. I mean, he's really an amazing human being. But still, come on, give it up. I mean, Jesus Christ. You know, this is the reason there are no term limits in the Constitution for anyone in any elected capacity. The ones for the presidency were added after FDR died. The reason there is because it never occurred to the founders that anybody would ever want to do this as a full-time job. That was not the idea. The idea is you're supposed to, you know, you get a little money, you get educated, you get a nice farm, and then you give a few years of your life to your country, and you go to Washington for a
Robert
few years.
Powell joined.
Then you come back. There you are. We got it.
I guess the reboot did the trick.
Yes, it did. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Yeah. And do you teach at the University of Austin?
No, I am not a professor. I'm retired out of the semiconductor industry.
Yeah, now I want to ask you about this because I know this is on your resume. I know this is completely off topic to why you're here, but I'm a computer programmer. Could you explain to the audience how you're one of the developers of flash memory, right?
Well, at the engineering level where you actually make the chips,
yeah,
I did not do programming.
No.
The
how does the chip work? I understand how. Okay, the spinning drives are basically real high tech versions of phonograph records. I understand that.
Right.
How does the flash memory actually work?
So the way it works is you have a what's called a gate, and then you have what we call a source and a drain, which are two little it's a transistor. And you actually tunnel the electrons through the silicon dioxide, sometimes silicon nitride, and it's only it's less than 100 angstroms thick. And so once the electron tunnels into that insulator, it gets trapped. And so that's how you have your ones and your zeros. Either your transistor has an excess of electrons that have been tunneled into it, or you have a transistor that has not happened to it. So that's your one and zero.
So how do you map the actual files? How does that work?
Well, Matt, now you're getting into the programming part and the designer. So
okay.
I didn't do the design work.
All right. That's the part I've always wondered. My impression is now they're starting to get this almost to the atomic level where that basically you can have basically atoms that will store the binary information, right?
Yeah. I mean, we just keep shrinking things further and further. And what I worked on was how do you keep the charge in that cell? So as you keep shrinking, it becomes harder and harder not for some of the charge to slowly leak off. So, you do little different things to maintain that charge. For example, this is something your audience is probably not going to be very interested in.
You'd be surprised, though. I've got a bunch of nerds watching this. So,
silicon dioxide, right? That's glass.
Yeah.
And that's a very good insulator. And that's what an initial gate transistors were made out of. And then as you needed something that was a better insulator, we went to silicon nitride. And then sometimes combinations of silicon oxide and silicon nitride. So it's an interesting subject. So when I first started working on flash products, you could, what we would say read and write. So, you'd program up a cell, discharge it, program it up, discharge it. You'd say, how many times can you do that? And initially, we were only doing it. We could do it 100 to 1,000 times, which... your laptop wouldn't last long,
right?
If you read and write.
Yeah, that's basically unusable, right? Yeah. Uh huh.
Right.
Yeah.
So and finally we got to where it would last millions, right, of read writes, and then we started to approach a billion read writes. So once you get there, then your laptop takes you more than a lifetime of playing on your laptop before your flash device would die.
Robert, humans are very we have a lot of geniuses, don't we? I mean, I'm constantly amazed by how we take really primitive ideas and perfect them to like just a ridiculous level. Unbelievable.
And that's right. And that perfection is small, and it gradually happens over time. So when someone says, oh, we learned about transistors from aliens, and, they gave us the clues. No, it was just hard work.
Yeah.
Increment by increment over many, many years.
Yeah. And so, all right. The guy who wrote The Day After Roswell, that's, what's his name again? Oh, Jesus, on the tip of my tongue. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
So he said that some of the stuff, including the transistor stuff, we got off crashed spacecraft. He's been a very contentious figure, but no one's ever been figuring out why he would lie. I don't believe that either. I'm with you. I mean, it's the development and evolution of that stuff pretty well documented. I don't think we get enough across space, but I don't understand why he said we did either. But anyway, Hey, so let's get to your book. Do you want to just very quickly summarize what your book is about? I did read it.
The book, and the name of the book is UFOs, Scientists Explains What We Know and What We Don't Know. And so the book is basically about the 17 years that I've spent on the subject and what I've learned. And I retired early from the semiconductor field. And this was one of the things on my list of, okay, now that I've retired early, what do I want to go do? And one of them was, oh, I'd like to go look at that UFO question and determine, you know, is that a bunch of BS or is there some reality to it? And so over the 17 years, I've been interviewed hundreds of witnesses. I've probably read thousands of reports, and I averaged probably 20 hours a week for the last 17 years studying this subject. So I'm very familiar. That's why for me, when you have a group like Arrow who spends probably 12 months at the most looking at the subject and tries to draw conclusions, I just find that, you know, kind of silly in a way.
Well, before you came on, I reiterated what I've told the audience in the past, and that is, you know, in the 1950s, and I can't remember which general it was that commissioned his minions in the Air Force to give him a report on UFOs, and the report said two things. It said the UFOs are real, they're real flying machines. That was one, and the second thing is we don't know where they're from or who's flying them. And the major thing is you go to 2021 and the congressional report that Arrow or ATIP, maybe it was I can't remember who even prepared for Congress. They had two conclusions. One is they're real flying machines. They're not mirages. They're not hallucinations. They're real machines, and we don't know who they are, who's flying them. So 80 years go by, same thing.
Yeah, and it's still true today.
Yeah.
We still don't know who's flying them and what they are.
Now, but I want to skip ahead. All right, the bulk of your book is basically kind of a historical review of what's happened. More, am I just categorizing this correctly?
Well, in the first chapter, I tried to write this book for someone who, you know, is not steeped in the UFO world.
Right.
So the first chapter is to give a reader a basic understanding of the history of UFOs. So that's what the first chapter goes through. But after the first chapter, I talk about other things such as how I know that the phenomenon or the UFOs are a physical reality and how I know that they're intelligently controlled. So I go through the reasoning of that in the book on all of the subsequent chapters. And then after I establish why I believe they're intelligently controlled, I go through other things such as, you know, what we should do in the future, you know, put theories on where they might originate from. And again, those are just, that's a hypothesis. We don't, there's no way for us to know where they originate from.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you've studied the situation so much that I'm actually interested in your speculation. But I want to get to, toward the end of, and you just referred to this, to the end of your book, you talked about various hypotheses and scenarios. And obviously, you spend a lot of time, you being a scientist yourself, about using the scientific method to try to figure out where these things are coming from, who's flying them. All right, but let me run an idea by you. So, I mean, I've studied this a lot too, and I'm not a scientist. So my thing is, okay, so Louis Alessandro on ATIP, he says, well, we've definitively concluded that these machines are real. So you pretty much come to the same conclusion. The machines are real. They're flying around. So this is the way I look at it. Well, there's only three possible alternatives. Either we designed and built them, we being the United States, or our adversaries designed and built them, that would be most likely China or Russia, or they're from off planet. And everyone seems to think that the first two of those scenarios is basically implausible at the present time. So can't I just conclude they're extraterrestrial? I mean, just by the process of elimination?
Well, yeah. I mean, the only other you know, the only other possibilities, right, that they could be terrestrial would be, and I'm not saying this is the case.
I understand.
Giving the
yeah.
other possibilities. One is that you have some hidden civilization
right.
on our planet, right, that we don't know about. Maybe it's deep in the ocean, and that's the source. So technically, they would be terrestrial.
Right, that's correct.
The other possibility would be if it's us from the future, which
yeah.
that would be terrestrial.
Yeah, and
but
also
otherwise, it has to be extraterrestrial.
As a scientist, do you think there's any chance that the time traveler scenario is real?
I have a hard time buying time travel.
Uh-huh.
I can't say that it's not possible, but I think it's very unlikely.
Yeah, I got the impression from your book that you have a less hard time buying the faster than the speed of light warp drive scenario. Is that correct?
Yeah, I could buy into, you know, that some technologies develop the ability to travel faster than light before I could buy into time travel.
Yeah, that's the reason I asked. So I was wondering, because I don't know what to think about it either. I really don't, the time travel thing. I mean, I suppose, and you allude to this, at the end of your book, you allude to this, and it's very, I appreciate, I thought, about the fact that, you know, we don't, I mean, 100 years ago, they actually thought humans couldn't travel faster than 45 miles an hour. I'm not kidding. You know, that's really true.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever read Stanton Friedman's book, Science Was Wrong. It's an entire survey of the 20th century of all this shit the scientists thought that turned out to be BS, you know? So, I mean, it's hard to imagine technology that we do not even have yet. That's true. But if you're going to, like, weigh those scenarios, I guess I agree with you. It's it's the time travel thing is harder to draw to buy than the faster than light scenario. All right, so let's
yep.
go ahead. No, go ahead. You're
right. And you don't really have to travel faster than light to have interstellar travel. You can still, you know, if you can get near the speed of light, then that's all that's required to have reasonable interstellar travel.
Yeah, but do I have this wrong? If you get, like, faster than, like, 80% of the speed of light, your mass increases, and that becomes a quandary too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like the closer you get to the speed of light, the more your mass increases. So the more energy it takes to get close to the speed of light.
Yeah.
However, if you have that ability to get close to the speed of light, right, then as you approach the speed of light, time begins to slow down. So at least for the individuals on a spacecraft traveling near the speed of light, you could go in just about anywhere in the galaxy over and over during your lifetime. Places are 20,000 light years away. Because you're not aging at the same
yeah.
rate we would be here on Earth. Of course, the problem is when you come back to your home world, everyone's dead and
right.
20,000 years have gone by.
Right. And I'm familiar with the concept, but I didn't actually realize the reality. You pointed out in the book that if you were going to go to Alpha Centauri 4 light years away and you're traveling at 99% of the speed of light, if you're on the spacecraft, that trip takes 3 weeks. Which I never put that together.
Yeah, or less, depending on how close to the speed of light that you get.
Yeah.
Now that one is easier to deal with, right? Because let's say we were going to Alpha Centauri and we could travel, you know, at almost the speed of light. You could basically be there within hours, for example, or weeks. And then you'd come back. And so 4 years went by as you went there, 4 years when you came back. So on Earth, all your relatives have aged 8 years.
Yeah.
You come back and you look basically the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you explain to our audience here how the techno signatures that we of these exoplanets that we find, how we can tell that there might be life on them?
Right, right. So when we look at a planet and you use spectrometers, for example, to look at what elements are in the atmosphere of those planets. So, for example, if you look at a planet and you see an indication of oxygen, some carbon dioxide, nitrogen, well, then you would be reasonably sure that that's a planet that could support life. And then if you get a certain telltale signals, for example, hydrogen sulfide or methane gas, that might tell you, okay, there's some level of life there. But let's say, for example, someone looking at our atmosphere and they pick up complex hydrocarbons, right, which mm-hmm. come from our manufactured plastics and other products, then you would know there's intelligent life. And if you picked up, for example, in our atmosphere, some isotopes of uranium, plutonium, then you would know, okay, whoever lives there has figured out how to split the atom.
Yeah.
Right. Or another way you do it, and we will have this ability, it may be another 30 to 40 years. But, okay, so you have a powerful telescope. You're looking, you want to look at the planet itself. But the sun is so bright that it blocks out the planet. So you basically take a what's called a coronagraph, which blocks out the sun, right, so that you can see the planet. And if someone was looking at our planet, for example, and they were looking at the dark side, they would see that there were light emissions, right? Their spectrograph would pick up the particular wavelength of incandescent light. And so they'd go, wait, what? Why is this wavelength of light on the dark side of the planet? Somebody's clearly lighting up, you know, their land masses.
Yeah.
Well, they would know, you know, you're at a certain level of development just by looking at our planet with their telescopes. So it's something that we are almost capable of doing already. I mean, so it's not out of the realm of thinking that, you know, a more advanced civilization was able to do that looking at us long ago.
Regardless of what you wrote in your book, are you aware of any technologies that are on the rise right now that are going to completely, like, blow people away? Are you on the cutting edge of any, you know? I mean, first thing I think of is quantum computing, but anything that comes to mind?
No, you know, not really. Nothing that's, you know, just going to blow people away. I mean, of course, a lot of people say, well, AI, but I'm not that impressed so far by AI. Not to say that it can't be, there might not be some impressive AI out there, but I mean, AI is just complicated algorithms developed to try to mimic what people do and you know,
yeah.
Garner more information.
Right.
I haven't seen an AI that makes me say, okay, there's a program that thinks on its own.
Well, do you think it's going to be as dangerous as some people do?
Well, I think once you reach that cusp, and if you were able to create an artificial intelligence that could think on its own, then I think I would agree with Elon Musk. Once you go through that tipping point, I'm not sure that you can reverse it.
So I assume you're familiar with the Turing test, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So for those of them watching, the Turing test was from Alan Turing in the 1960s. He said, and then you were talking to a computer via a teletype. He said, if you can't tell the difference between a computer talking back to you and a human, you basically solved electronic intelligence. Well, that turns out to be bullshit. But the real thing is, will we if this artificial intelligence actually becomes sentient, will we even know when we cross a line?
We might not know initially.
Yeah.
But at some point, you might, you know, find that out. But you know, I think the bigger risk for us is without it ever crossing that line, right, that we give up our needs to AI, right? So, for example, if I have a virtual reality that I can live in that's just wonderful, and so you reach a point where it's kind of like the Matrix, right? It's just like, you know, hook me up to the feeding tubes, and I'm just going to live this wonderful life of whatever I imagine and whatever I want. And I see that as the bigger risk, where humans just freely give away that power because of, you know, what they enjoy.
I'm 68 years old. I'm going to need a really big feeding tube. Oh, okay. So Robert, let's segue into another idea you had. You have the benevolent life hypothesis. Now, let's set this up. There's several different hypotheses of how ET would deal with humans. And one is the great filter theory. Then the other is, what is it called, the rare earth theory?
And there's the zoo hypothesis.
Yeah, the zoo hypothesis, right. Okay, let's go through just quickly, because I want to actually dwell on yours, because I find yours really fascinating. The rare earth theory is the fact there just isn't a lot of intelligent life, right?
Well, in rare earth, there's just not much out there.
Right.
You know, we're rare. But, you know, this harkens back to we're the unique species. No one else gets to exist besides us. And we're the center of the universe kind of thing. And then you have the zoo hypothesis, which means that there may be multiple civilizations out there, but they're just looking at us like you look at animals in a zoo.
Right.
Yeah. And then you have the great filter hypothesis, which is that there's something out there that eliminates civilizations before they ever develop the ability of interstellar travel. And there's several different, you know, versions of that theory. You know, one is that, you know, something happens such as a supernova that eliminates a civilization, or just a large solar storm from the sun, which could pretty much eliminate us if we had a large, what's called a carrion.
Well, what is the name of the event that happened in the 1900s?
In the 1800s.
Yeah.
It's named after scientist Carrington. And in that event, there was a solar storm powerful enough that the telegraph wires induced enough current into them that they actually melted and destroyed telegraph wires. If that was to happen today, it would basically fry our entire electrical grid system, because our electrical grid is not grounded.
Right.
And there were some scientists that went before Congress to say, you know, this is something we need to worry about. But the cost to ground our electrical grid system was something like $4 trillion. And so, you know, nobody wanted to do that. So hopefully that never happens.
Yeah, hopefully.
Because the other thing that would probably happen along with losing the grid is you probably lose all your GPS satellites.
Right.
And you know how many people know how to get from point A to point B without their cell phone?
Yeah, there's also those satellites are used for a whole bunch of basically hidden features that people don't even know about too.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So your theory, what you call the benevolent life theory, explain this.
So in my theory, what I see is the great filter is whether or not we're a benevolent species or a malevolent species. So if you're a malevolent species, that means you're fairly warlike, which reading the morning newspaper, you could easily argue we're fairly warlike.
Absolutely, right.
And so the argument is that a civilization develops, you will first develop the ability to annihilate yourself before you develop the ability to travel interstellar through space.
Yeah.
And for us, I would estimate, I mean, we've been able to annihilate ourselves probably for about 50 years now. And interstellar travel is probably at least several hundred years away.
Yeah.
So that means we have to survive as a species for several hundred more years before we could ever go and someone on Alpha Centauri, right?
Yeah.
So the benevolent hypothesis I have is that the highest likelihood is that any civilization that would come and, you know, visit us is going to be benevolent because otherwise they would have destroyed themselves before they ever went into interstellar space.
Right.
And if they're benevolent, then that means they are thinking about what they're doing, right? And we're a little bit benevolent, right? I mean, we sent a spacecraft to Saturn, a Galileo, and we burned it up in the atmosphere so that we wouldn't contaminate potentially another world. So we worry about those things. So if another civilization worried about us, they would say, okay, if we contact this civilization, how would our contact with them impact that civilization? And so it's most likely that they would determine that contacting us, you know, if they're too far advanced of us, would be detrimental. And you can imagine how it is. I mean, look what happened to the Native Americans.
Yeah.
The Europeans.
Oh, there's all sorts of examples. I mean, yeah. Look what happened to us, even the stupid War of the Worlds thing in the 1930s. You know, I mean, there's some people that think the government actually put Orson Welles up to that just to see what would happen, you know. But the fact of the matter is it did not go well.
Right.
And that was fiction.
Yeah. And you can imagine, how do we react if a civilization comes here and they've already figured out interstellar travel? They've already figured out everything that we're trying to figure out. So it's like, well, who's motivated to go figure anything out anymore?
That's right.
It's like, these guys have it. Why don't they just give it to us?
Yeah. I found in your book, the thing I found kind of fascinating is you didn't exactly have really nice things to say about SETI. And I have to say, I agree with you on that stuff. It's like, you know, first of all, you point out the fact they're looking in a very narrow radio or frequency range of radio, which probably is, you know, became, on some other world became obsolete in like 30 seconds or something like that. And also, I'm really glad you wrote about this. You're talking, and forgive me, I can't pronounce this, the astrocentric version of that humans have of ourselves, that we're the center of everything. And the problem is that if we're dealing with the extraterrestrials, we're not going to be the center of any of that shit.
Right, right,
you know, and
right,
you brought up the fact that SETI seems to kind of, they can't get rid of this idea, you know, and I agree with you, they can't.
Yeah, I just find it amazing that you can say, okay, I believe there are advanced civilizations out there. And I believe it because I'm trying to pick up radio signals from them, right? So I'm fine with that, right? And the next step is, okay, do they know we're here? Well, 30 years ago, SETI argued, no, they wouldn't know we're here. I mean, we're just a little blue dot, right?
Out there.
But based on what we've already done, we know we're already looking for the planets that we caught, Goldilocks planets, right?
Yeah.
So we're looking, and we will know one of these days we'll be able to identify the planets that are likely to have intelligent life. So now today, SETI, you know, I'm sure has to say, okay, they're out there and they probably know we're here, right? So the only thing left that they get to argue is, but they can't get here, right?
Yeah.
So you argue they can't get here because of interstellar distances. But I find that a very weak argument for a civilization that's, say, several hundred years more advanced than us.
So I talk to a lot of people on the show who say they've had encounters with aliens. You know, I do. I talk to them, you know. I mean, what is your feeling on this? I have to tell you, I had a guy on about 2 weeks ago named Bruce Solheim. He's a college professor. And I have a friend of mine who watches the show and doesn't buy any of the UFO shit at all. None of it. And so this guy, he says he's been talking to this alien named Anzar most of his life. That's what he says. He's a one particular alien, not a bunch of them, just one of them. And my friend watched the show, and he said, but, you know, that guy comes – no one could watch this and say that guy was crazy. And that was actually one of the reasons I wanted to have him on, because you're right. He's a very, very – he comes off as a very extremely sane individual. And he says he's been talking to these aliens. I talked to other people who say they've been talking to aliens, or they said they've had the experiences. Obviously, if they've had these experiences, the aliens are coming here. What do you think of this? Do you think it's all BS, or what's your personal opinion? Am I putting you on the spot here? I'm sorry, I didn't mean
no,
to.
No, it's fine. My degree is in chemistry, so I don't have any background in sociology or psychology. So I actually, I don't feel like I'm qualified to get into that. And part of the reason is because I'm fairly confident that a certain percentage of the population that says this, there are, some psychological issues.
Yes.
But then there may be another part of the population where maybe it's real.
Right? Yeah.
But I can't differentiate between the two because I don't have that type of experience.
Yeah.
So let's assume for a moment that a certain percentage of these claims are real.
Okay.
So there's a couple of possibilities that come to mind to me. One would be that it actually physically happens, right?
Right.
The other possibility is that it didn't physically happen at all. But if you're assuming that you're dealing with an intelligence much more advanced than you, they could theoretically put the entire scene and scenario in your head.
Yes, that's correct. They could.
As far as you're concerned, it happened.
Right. There's a lot of people who think that's what's going on,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in that type of scenario, an advanced civilization, they might not even be here. They might be light years away and
doing
it to
you. That's correct. They could, yeah.
And that's pure conjecture on my part.
Well, yeah.
I don't have any evidence. I'm just talking about, possibilities.
But I want to point out that 100 years ago when radio, stupid radio raised its ugly head, people found that's just amazing. Here's another thing I want to run by you too. One of the things you ask in your book is whether we're dealing with one possible, when in terms of the UAPs, one single civilization or a whole bunch of them. And I've contended for a long time, I think the galaxy is teeming with life, and I think we're dealing with a whole shitload of them. So if that's the case, we would be dealing with civilizations anywhere from 200 to 100,000 years ahead of us. So the span of technology within those people, I'll use the word people, is actually within them is enormous. 200, if you're talking about 200 years, you're talking about basically what you're talking about just right now. That is, like us flying to Alpha Centauri, at almost the speed of light, taking 4 years. There might be people visiting us that are doing that. And then, you might have a civilization that's so damn freaking advanced, they are actually planting ideas in our head from like 50 light years away. That sounds absurd to us, but there's a whole bunch of stuff we've already done that's absurd. You brought this up in your book about the fact that, the cell phone in my pocket is about 10,000 more times more powerful than it was barely a computer on the Apollo spacecraft. It was basically a calculator,
yeah.
That's only in the space of 50 years. If you gave it 100,000 years, holy shit, what are we doing?
That's part of the consideration when you talk about, how many civilizations are out there? Because for all practical purposes, a civilization that was thousands of years more advanced than us, and you have to remember in terms of geological time, that's like nothing.
That's right. Yeah.
That would be so far advanced that it would be difficult for there even to be communication.
Right. Right?
It would be very difficult. But, to your question, Jim, I kind of look at it this way. Either we're in the situation where there is no life out there and we're all by ourselves, or there's just life everywhere. Because that's what we see on Earth, is if I go to the ocean and I catch a perch out in the ocean, and that's the first time I was ever in the ocean, well, the odds are there's other fish besides that perch, right? Now, if I go in the ocean, I don't catch anything, then I might conclude, okay, it's a dead ocean.
Right. Right.
But once you catch the first one, then you have to assume, okay, there's going to be more. And I think that would be the same for life in our galaxy. And then what it boils down to is, right, because a civilization like us, for example, if you said we kind of started off 2,000 years ago as a meaningful level of civilization, I mean, just a 4,000-year gap, right, from 0 AD to 4,000 AD, your other civilizations need to be in that gap for you to be able to kind of communicate with them, right? So all the guys below that gap and all of them above that gap, it's going to be difficult to communicate. But I think it's likely if there's, you know, one civilization out there that has visited us, then there will have been many. And if I had to guess, and this is pure guessing, right, because we don't, in my book, I talk about two things I know. But the things we don't know are such as, is it one civilization or many? And if I my gut feel is that it's many civilizations, and I suspect often they just pass by and continue on their way after they do their first check just to see what's here.
You brought up in your book, and I'm really glad you mentioned this too, about Carl Sagan's very famous quote about extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. And you basically said that that's bullshit. I'm paraphrasing you, forgive me. But I've always thought that too. It is bullshit because it's actually, in a way, it's the opposite. It's like if you're talking about all these like people who said they've had these abductions, if you could prove one single one definitively, that means the phenomena is real. It's almost the opposite of extraordinary proof. It's like all you need to do, you know, if you have 10,000 people that said they've been abducted, if you could actually prove one of them, well, then it's kind of like catching fish, perch in the ocean, just like you're saying. If it's happened once, it's probably happened again, you know. And so I'm kind of glad you pointed that out because I've always thought that was kind of BS. It's like,
yeah. And I mean, plus, I mean, evidence is evidence. There's no such thing as extraordinary evidence and horrible evidence. Right.
I mean, yeah.
What's horrible evidence? What's extraordinary evidence? I mean, it's evidence.
Yeah.
And so that's just like a advertising gimmick, right? It sounds cool.
Yeah.
Oh, extraordinary claim. I want extraordinary evidence.
Yeah.
Evidence is evidence.
He was good at getting attention for the cause, but sometimes I wonder about some of that stuff. All right,
which is great because he really got people interested in science.
Right, I know. You can't actually put it down because you're right. It served a function. It actually did. This is something you didn't address at all, and I'm really curious, especially because your scientific mind, what you think about this, and that is this is something I've been playing, an idea I've been playing with for quite a while. We always just assume that our civilization, that another civilization is basically going to evolve the same as ours in terms of scientific discoveries, that sort of thing. Here's an example. Like we don't really know anything about gravity still. I mean, supposedly, I mean, there are people say, well, there's black projects in the government that they figured it out. But, you know, publicly, we don't really know anything about gravity. And I've always thought, well, what if it turns out that somebody else cracked that really early, you know, where it would be like, I mean, sometimes I've wondered, is this something that's really simple that for some reason we've just missed? You know, so, I mean, I don't think we can assume that another civilization would evolve in the same steps that we have. Are you following what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, I'm following you completely. I mean, and I've wondered about that in the world of physics, right? It's like, okay, if we had gone down some different path, right, than the one where the atom and the electron, for example, the electron is kind of a cloud. You have an object that's, you know, you can locate it, but you can't know how fast it's moving.
Or vice versa, right.
Yeah, or vice versa. So you just have this cloud that goes around the atom. I've always wondered, okay, well, if we had approached it from a different angle, maybe, you know, maybe we'd have a different view of things and would learn something, you know, differently. You know, it's kind of hard to say, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
It's the same. It's just like you do, and I think this is what you're alluding to. What if, like, we had come up with quantum physics before traditional physics, you know? What if we'd be looking at life completely differently, or science, if you reverse those two things? I mean, we would. Because right now people have a hard time buying quantum physics. Well, I mean, the public does. I mean, you know, it's because it's counterintuitive. I mean, you explain this to people, it doesn't make any sense, you know? But it's like, if we had talked about that first, maybe that would be the benchmark. I don't know. It's, you know, just way to look at that. I just want to know what you thought, that's all, because I don't hear people talking about that very much. So, okay, hold on a second. I got a bunch of questions. That's what I do. You end the last chapter of your book, you actually discuss this, and I thought this is a really good topic about the fact you're talking about the fact that by contacting ET, we might end up bettering ourselves. And the reason I like this idea is because you're talking about your benevolent life theory. And this is the way I kind of looked at this. Okay, so a lot of warring on the planet here by humans has to do with resources, you know, and our economics are based on resources. So, like, for example, a couple of hundred years from now, that replicator on Star Trek becomes a real thing and you can get Earl Grey tea hot out of your microwave, you know, right? Okay, and then if you want to, well, I mean, you're probably not going to have cars with wheels, but you want your transportation device, you want a big one, you go down to the Civic Center and they have a big machine and they just make you one. But the point is, none of this stuff would really cost anything. It would completely change our economics, totally, completely. And at that point, when you're at that point, the energy involved to do that basically means you can do anything, and we basically would have no real needs anymore. So you could speculate that we would become a lot more benevolent species because we're not fighting over anything, although we're almost at that point already. I mean, even now, the wars on the planet are basically pointless now. We're not really fighting over, you know, resources anymore. And so you were talking about your benevolent life theory about the fact that, all right, so if you have the energy to travel interstellar, you probably don't have any needs, any resource needs on your home planet anymore. I'm making a grand generalization, you know?
Right.
So if that's the case, I have to tie together an idea. Holy shit. But my point is that you were talking about bettering ourselves, and I think this actually bolsters your theory in the sense that if someone has an energy to come here, they probably have no longer have any resource needs per se. So most, why not be benevolent?
Yeah, and I mean, if someone can get here, because some people say, oh, they're going to come here and take our resources. Now, if you have the ability to travel interstellar, you don't need to come this far to get some resources, right?
Right.
You just get them in the local area, or you just make them yourself, you know, using energy. So
this is also the thing, you know, when I hear about people say, well, the ETs are coming here for gold. They don't need to come here for gold. They're making gold. You know, okay. We can't manufacture elements, but we can manufacture pretty much any molecule anybody wants. It's only one more step. I mean, I'm sure at some point we'll be putting together elements too. I don't think that's any big stretch at this point. You know, do you know who a guy named Charles Hall? Have you ever heard of him, Robert?
No.
Okay, so he's a guy. He's a physicist, and he says that for 2 years between 1963 and 1965. He was in the U.S. Navy, and he was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, where he was a weatherman. He did weather for the base. And he said that during that time, he interacted with a bunch of extraterrestrials who had a secret base for the ETs to land at Nellis Air Force Base. I mean, this is totally fantastical shit. I mean, it is. He's written 6 books about this. Either he is the greatest novelist on the planet, or this is really true, one or the other. I mean, it's incredibly detailed. But he says He spent the rest of his life as a physicist. He said that the ETs were ordering off-the-shelf parts from the Army to fix their spacecraft. And one of the things they were ordering, which in 1963 was brand new, was fiber optic cable. He said they ordered miles of it. And what he found out is that they were making, it was basically an electric generator, as like ours were, except it used another molecule. It used another, it wasn't electrons. It used another subatomic particle. And he claims, and he did have a legitimate career as a physicist after he got out of the Army. He claims he spent the rest of his career trying to figure out what was powering that damn thing and couldn't figure it out. And I don't know why I brought this up, but I find the whole thing just fascinating because the thing is, going back to that thing about the order in which you develop technology. Yeah, so like, what if he's right? I mean, yeah, it's just a simple thing. It's just whatever the boson, you put a Higgs boson in an electrical generator, and you get some sort of, he said that was driving the anti-gravity part of the spacecraft, but he couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. So, I have a tendency not to buy into those.
Yeah, I understand. But still, you're a scientist. I kind of want your comment,
Right. So take, for example, anti-gravity, the whole thing where people say, we're getting anti-gravity. You could have, let's just magically say that our government had anti-gravity, right?
Yeah.
You could have anti-gravity and you can't do what these UFOs or UAP do, right? Because they have instant acceleration.
Yeah.
Acceleration is independent of gravity. I mean, gravity may keep you from accelerating as much as you want to, but you could put our spacecraft in outer space and launch, a Saturn V out. Let's just say you could put it out in space and launch it. Well, it still can't accelerate at high, at high velocities.
Mm-hmm.
That is totally different than whether you have gravity or anti-gravity, right? Gravity, having anti-gravity just means it would be the same as if you were in space instead of being here on the Earth.
Yeah.
But that doesn't give you instantaneous acceleration. That's something totally different because you have to accelerate a mass, right? Whether you're on the Earth or you're in space, you're still accelerating a mass. And the only way that I can think of, well, there's two ways that you can accelerate an object at these high accelerations. Either you drive the mass of the object to zero. So let's say, for example, if I could make your inert, you have your gravitational mass, right?
Right.
So here, let's say you weigh 180 pounds. If I put you on Mars, you may only weigh 100 pounds, right? So that's
all
your
right.
Gravitational mass. But your inertial mass is always the same. And if I could drive your inertial mass to zero, right, then I could shine a flashlight on you, and the energy of those photons, which are moving at the speed of light, would suddenly push you at the speed of light because you don't have any mass anymore.
Yeah.
And you would have instantaneous acceleration. You would go from zero to the speed of light almost instantly.
So based on what you know about how the way these UAPs operate, do you think that's part of it, is that they can adjust the mass of their objects?
Well, all I can say is that would be a possibility. Now, let me say, no one has proven that you can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as we know, gravitational mass and inertial mass are the same.
Right.
And if that's true, then you can't do that. But if it's possible that you can do that, then that could explain some of the features that you see. The only other way to do that extreme acceleration is some type of wormhole where you basically are creating this huge mass in front of the object, and the object is accelerating basically like towards a black hole.
Yeah.
And so it's the acceleration is sudden, But you have all sorts of problems with such a theory, right? It's like, okay, well, how come the Earth isn't getting sucked into that black hole and
right.
And all the other stuff around it? So
well, you alluded to this in your book about the fact that NASA, first of all, I can never remember this guy's name, the Mexican physicist who basically has come up with what's called warp drive.
I never can remember his name either.
Abercrombie or whatever the hell it is. So if I'm right, there's a guy at NASA named Sonny Houston. And you alluded to this in your book, but didn't really talk about the fact that they're actually want to put a spacecraft up to actually test this theory about the fact about the basically it's like you create a black hole in front of you or something like that. It's like, isn't that what it is?
Yeah, so, and you're basically being sucked down this wormhole
right.
to another point in, you know, in space.
Right, and it's not so much that that's you're traveling fast at the speed of light. It's kind of like it's a shortcut. It doesn't really violate Einstein's principles. It's just that you end up going faster than you could.
Yeah, the best example, I guess, is like you take a balloon and you know, to go from this side to this side, you have to go around this side of the balloon. But if you pinch the balloon together, right, you can suddenly go from, instead of going all the way around, you're suddenly there.
Yeah. So do you know, from what I understand, they're actually going to do this. Have you heard anything about this? Or?
I don't know how they would. I mean, my understanding, it takes an enormous amount of energy, more
right.
energy than we've ever produced to date.
That's so. Correct. That's what I understand, too. So I don't know how they do it either. Although I understand that this Houston guy at NASA, he's figured out how to greatly reduce the amount of energy you need. But that said, it's still a shitload. I mean, you can't, you know. I don't know if you follow this, a guy named Richard Dolan. I mean, his thing, he's really in connected with a with the Defense Department, the basically black projects. And he said not only crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft, we have this now. And his big thing is, and of course, if that's true, he's right, is that if by not giving this power source to the public, it's basically a crime. I mean, because this would solve all our energy needs, however they're doing it. But, I mean, he points out the same thing. You're right. It takes a ridiculous amount of power to do this.
Yeah, but I guess I would disagree with him. Then I don't believe we have ever reverse engineered, any alien spacecraft. I mean, even let's just assume we have one.
Yeah, hold it. I'd want to ask you two things. Okay, maybe do we have them? Even if we haven't reverse engineered them, do you think we have some?
I mean, you know, if you believe David Grush, right?
Right.
Then we have some.
Yeah.
But you know, that's kind of he has two pieces of evidence, people he talks to and documents he's read.
Yeah.
The more important of those two, I think, are the documents. And so that's a black and white issue that Congress should be able to ascertain.
Yeah.
Right? He tells them, okay, here's the name of the documents, here's who has them. Then it's up to them to go get the documents, verify it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a science project, right, that we can resolve. It's either true or it's
correct.
Not true.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, okay, so let's assume it's true and we've got, some alien crap. I don't believe we could reverse engineer them.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because, I mean, we might be able to figure out, okay, what is the outside surface made out of?
Right.
With a spectrograph or something. But, you know, to actually understand how something works. Like I worked at Advanced Micro Devices, and we would, on the flash product, I was reverse engineering Intel products, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was very difficult, and that's a technology we knew, you know, and where you know everything about it. But to do something that's a totally different technology, that, like you mentioned earlier, may have been developed on a different science basis than our science, I think it's next to impossible. I mean, take, for example, a laptop. You could take a laptop today, give it with all the schematics, how you build the laptop, how you build the chips that go into the laptop, and give it to the scientists of 1991, right? That's not that long ago.
No, it isn't. No, right. 30 years ago, right.
Could they build it? No. There's no way they could.
That's fascinating. You're absolutely right. They couldn't.
No, because, for example, you have to have photographic, we call them steppers, but they're pieces of photographic equipment today that can basically, that are printing in the ultraviolet light range, and they're printing submicron, you know, patterns in order to develop the modern computer chip. Well, if you gave the schematics of how to make the laptop to the guys from 1991, that they don't have the printing technique, right?
Right.
To be able to even print the chip. They don't have the metallurgy techniques to create the copper aluminum matrix that we use today, right? And it goes on with dozens and dozens of base technologies, right? Because to make a computer chip and a laptop, you've got just dozens and dozens of technologies that have to be developed to get to the final product.
Yeah.
So no one can, I can give you all the schematics. Here's how you build it. And the guy from 1991, there's no way he can do it.
Robert, that's the most eloquent explanation I've ever heard of why they wouldn't be able to do it. They reverse. I mean, there's a theory. I'm having a UFO panel on Thursday, three highly qualified guys. And I don't know if you've heard this, but there's, so a lot of people seem to think that we do actually have these crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft. Whether we've reverse engineered them, there's two camps. One is that we have, and like I said, people say, well, that's kind of a crime if you're not going to release that information to the public. But the other one is that the government doesn't want to admit the fact they can't crack it, that they just, they have them and they can't figure it out.
Yeah. If they have it here, this would be my guess as to how it all happened. Sometime back in the 1950s, right, or 1940s, they get one or two of these things. And back in the 40s and 50s, they look at it and they can't do diddly.
Right.
So they just mothball it, right?
Yeah.
And 70 years goes by and they go, oh, yeah, well, let's go see if we can figure this out this time. And they haul it back out and they still can't figure it out.
Right.
So.
I've had this story for years about the fact that, okay, here's my scenario. You're at Valley Forge in 1775, and you land a 747, and you tell George Washington, said, this giant metal bird, this thing flies, and it's totally fueled up. You can have it. They'd never figure it out in a million years, not even how to fucking fly the thing, let alone how it works. You know, they wouldn't know. They just wouldn't know.
And for example, they wouldn't know that they need a flat runway.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. Fred,
they're going to get a flat runway.
Yeah, I landed it in a forest, but yeah, okay, in my mind. But yeah, no, they would never, ever figure it out. They hadn't even seen plastic, you know? It's like, shit.
Right, I mean, it's just like if you gave this laptop, I mean, this smartphone to someone from 100 years ago, right? Well, the smartphone doesn't work unless I have an internet connection.
Right.
He doesn't even know what an internet connection is. So
yeah.
What can he learn from this thing?
Yeah. And when the power goes out, it's a brick.
Yeah, exactly. It's a brick.
Oh, okay. So I had one more question for you. Now, let me see. What was it? Let me see if I can figure this out here. I probably can't. Are you working on anything new? Oh, hell, just a second. Tell us about what is the name of the current, hold on. You're with the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, okay, so the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies is a group that's made up of a little bit over 300 people, over 30% have PhDs. Over half have an advanced degree of some type. They're mostly scientists, a lot that have come out of the defense industry. Over 20% of our membership is from other countries. So it's a truly international organization. And actually, Jim, we have a conference coming up, which people can attend on live streaming. And so you can actually sit in your own home and you can ask questions.
When is that, Robert?
It will be May 31st to June 2nd, so just a few weeks from now.
Would you send me the information for this? I'll put it on our blog. I'll tune into that myself, too. So.
Yeah, it's basically if they go to explorescu.org, and there's a link right there. But it's pretty neat because we actually have like these round tables where they just randomly mix you up, people that are, you know, remotely at the conference.
Oh, that's cool.
And so you spend 10 minutes introducing yourselves, talking to each other, and then the computer randomly mixes you again, and you got three new people to meet. And that's just one little thing that's done. And then, of course, you know, you listen to the speakers, you can ask questions. You can also even interact with the people at the conference using the software system that we have. So it's really a neat conference. And a lot of interesting people come to our conference. 2 years ago, David Grush was one of the guys at our conference.
Wow.
At the time, no one knew who he was.
Right.
Because he hadn't gone public or anything.
Yeah.
And we didn't know it until after the fact. The head of the UAP task force was at our conference that same year also.
You can count me in. I'm gonna do this. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll enjoy it. It's pretty good. I'll send you the link and everything.
Yeah, we'll put it up on our blog too, along with a link to your book on Amazon. David, I can't thank you enough. I've enjoyed this immensely. I hope I didn't talk too much. That's like my
problem. No, I enjoyed it. It was a great conversation. You know, we talked about things, Jim, that others don't always talk about. So it's kind of.
I'm glad to hear that. That's good. That's good. So when you write your next book, you make certain to come back too. I'll make sure to track you down. But I'm going to be at your conference on the 31st. That sounds really interesting. I'm going to do that.
Okay, great. Well, I'll shoot you a hello when you're at the conference.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Robert. You take care. We'll see you soon. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Good.
Bye bye.
Good. Thank you. Bye bye.
That's Robert Powell. He's the author of UFOs, What Science Knows and What We Don't Know. Something like that. I can't remember. Oh, my God. What the hell is with me anyway? I hope you found that interesting as much as I did. And, you know, it's like, yeah, maybe I'm a little selfish here. I get some of these guests on mostly so I can talk to them. It's like I just find this stuff endlessly fascinating, and I hope you do too. So that's... I'm going to, we went over time as we usually do now. I had one thing for part three tonight. And for those of you who've never seen the show before, part three is a part where we talk about all the wacky, weird shit. And actually this is interesting. Well, everything's interesting, isn't it? I don't know. So I don't know if you saw this, you know, Netflix did a roast of Tom Brady, the quarterback. And the thing about this roast, now I haven't watched the roast. I've only seen clips of it. I haven't watched it. But everyone who's seen it, including the clips I've seen, seems to think this was a watershed moment for comedy because for the first time in ages, first of all, they did it live. And everyone said you got to give Netflix credit, kudos for that, because the fact that they actually – you know, no one had a chance to edit this. You know, none of it was pre-scripted. None of it. You got a bunch of comments. You know how roasts work, you know. But everyone said that it was like the first time in ages they'd seen anything that was completely politically incorrect. It was like nobody gave a shit about what they were saying. It's like, and, you know, a lot of people are saying this might be a turning point culturally in what's going on. I think it might be, too. You know, we've had, Jeff Meyer was on last week. I've been talking to people. Tim Conaway's coming on Tuesday about the fact that there seems to be a slow tide turning within the public. People are getting tired of this shit, and that shit basically means political incorrectness and cancel culture and all that. People are just growing tired of it. I predicted this. I said this yesterday about the fact that I think that the election is going to in November, assuming. Nothing. There's no big, huge event before that, but I think it's going to be way more lopsided than people think it's going to be. I have the feeling that there's a lot of people who call themselves Democrats who are going to go in the voting booth and pull the lever for Trump and not tell a soul. So, I mean, it'll be interesting. We'll see, because people are just they're tired of living this way, and especially comedy. Now, a friend of mine called me. He's in finance today, and he says, well, Disney lost $680 million last year. Yeah, they did. That's right. They made eight major movies, and seven of them completely bombed. And why? Well, the movies are bad. It's like, that's all there's to it. It's like, you know, and John Nolte and Breitbart, he goes on about this endlessly, and he's endlessly entertaining doing it. But he said, no, you can talk about the pandemic. You can talk about the strike. You know about all sorts of shit. They're shitty movies. That's all there is to it, you know? And he thinks the shitty movies are because of woke culture infiltrating these companies, and I have a tendency to agree. I think he's right, you know? Because comedy is not pretty and isn't polite, and it's not supposed to be. Yeah, my two bits there. And I think we're just going to end it with that. So now tomorrow night, we're taking the night off. Like once again, I got to go to the doctor. They fill me full of drugs. I feel like shit. You know, I'm just not going to buy. I don't have time to prep for the show. I don't want to do the show. It's like, you know, I'm old and tired. So we're taking the night off. Thursday night, as I was mentioning to Robert Powell, we have our UFO panel. That's John Greenwald, Mika Hanks, and Jazz Shaw are joining us. So we're going to talk about the UFO world. And I found this really interesting with what Robert was talking about, because he's got a really good point. People are saying, well, okay, we've got crash tests on terrestrial spacecraft. You know, I think Robert's right. I don't think we can reverse engineer this shit, or at least not well, at least not to replicate it, you know? So, I mean, who knows? Now, Bob Lazar said we were, but if you have the technology to fly across the galaxy, can we relate to that shit? No, we can't. I don't know. I don't know what to think. You know, there's a lot of people, but the thing is, that's a very, very credible response and opinion. It just is. It gets, you know, I just gave the example about landing the 747 at Valley Forge. They would never figure it out. And those are our own people 200 years ago. They would never figure out an aircraft, a modern aircraft, never in a million years. Even if you told them it could fly, and it looks like a bird, it kind of does. This machine flies. It's all gassed up, ready to go. Go ahead. You can have it. Nope, they never figured it out. They wouldn't. So that's on Thursday. Next week, I still don't know. I'll let you know on Thursday. There's a possibility. I have another doctor's appointment on Monday. We might take Monday off too. Tim Conaway's coming on Tuesday. And then the dynamic duo on Wednesday. And we'll hopefully have another guest for next Thursday too. So at any rate, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. I want to thank Robert Powell for joining us. Fascinating discussion. It was very, very good. I'm Jim Peters. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. We'll see you on Thursday night. Take care, everybody.